Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, a bill designed to improve workers' rights, including protecting employees from third-party harassment, is currently being debated in the House of Lords. We'll be speaking to a policy officer from the TUC about the significance of this bill.
Also, the Justice Secretary has unveiled plans to build three new prisons and limit the duration of recall to a month in an attempt to tackle the ongoing overcrowding crisis in prisons. A former prison governor will be joining us to discuss whether we need a complete overhaul of the prison system.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
These rules become even more important. Without them, we risk becoming an island of strangers, not a nation that walks forward together. So when you have an immigration system that seems almost designed to permit abuse, that encourages some businesses to bring in lower paid workers rather than invest in our young people, or simply one that is sold by politicians to the British people on an entirely false premise, then you're not championing growth, you're not championing justice, or however else people defend the status quo. You're actually contributing to the forces that are slowly pulling our country apart. So yes, I believe in this. I believe we need to reduce immigration significantly.
So Keir Starmer has promised to bring down migration numbers by tightening up the rules on those allowed to come to the UK. The Prime Minister said his plan would reduce net migration by 2029. New measures include overseas workers will now need a degree-level qualification to apply for the main skilled worker visa instead of the equivalent A-level. And immigrants will typically have to live in the UK for 10 years before applying the right to a stay indefinitely, doubled the current five-year period. There'll also be a dedicated visa for social care workers introduced during the COVID pandemic, which will close to new applicants next month. Overseas graduates will only be able to stay in the UK for 18 months after their studies instead of 2 years. And language requirements for all work visas will increase, while adult dependents of visa holders will be required to demonstrate a basic understanding of English to come on a spousal and partner route. Several MPs criticised Starmer for his language, particularly this warning that the UK risks becoming an island of strangers, which was a near direct echo of the language used by Enoch Powell in his famous Rivers of Blood speech. Downing Street rejected the comparison, but they said the Prime Minister would not shy away from direct talk about the subject. And now today, Starmer is in Albania, where he announced that he was in talks with several countries about setting up returns hubs to send failed asylum seekers, as well as joint efforts with Albania to tackle people smuggling gangs. Ali, let's start with the speech. Do you think it was deliberate, this island of strangers line? Do you think he was deliberately echoing Enoch Powell?
I don't know if he knew that he was directly echoing Enoch Powell, but it's an insult to the intelligence of any functional human being to suggest that it was completely unknown to the speechwriters and the comms people at Number 10 that this was a near direct echo of Enoch Powell, largely because I know how speeches are written in political offices. I know how many rounds and how many eyesights, particularly a major announcement speech, will be given. So the suggestion that that no one in Number 10 knew that this was a near direct echo of Enoch Powell, or that these lines will be seen at least as reminiscent of the Rivers of Blood speech, is expecting the audience to be imbeciles, which the British people and the political attuned are not. It's the definition of the most reactionary form of politics. I think we have to not lose sight of the focus and the context in which this speech comes, which was we were just battered in the locals by reform. And rather than taking a look inwards as to, you know, what in the near year that Labour have been in government has disconnected so many people, where I think a third of Labour voters from 2024 are now saying that they regret that decision. Everything from the cuts to PIP, disability cuts, two child limit, welfare reforms, Gaza, all these things have amalgamated. Rather, when, you know, there's now an attempt to court Lee Anderson instead of traditional Labour voters is pretty pathetic, to be honest. And it's not going to work. It's just not going to work. Like, we've said it so many times. When in history has a political project mirroring the talking points of their opponents been a success?
Well, I mean, it's also the fact that, as you point out, you know, there are plenty of core voters for Labour who will now wonder if they can conscionably vote for Labour again, and maybe looking at the Liberal Democrats or the Greens, for example. And, you know, as we've said so many times on this programme, when you repeat populist right talking points, you send people directly into the arms. I mean, who's going to have heard this speech and thought, okay, yeah, I'll vote for Starmer then? If someone was, you know,
this way inclined,
surely they'd go for whoever's going to be strongest on immigration.
Do you know the problem is, you just mentioned that driving people into the arms. The reality that politicians like Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer don't get is that their words have very real consequences in society. If we look at, so Enoch Powell's River of Blood speech, we can directly link that to people, to violence on our streets and people losing their lives and race riots and racially motivated hate crime. Boris Johnson speaking about Muslim women increased Islamophobia, there was correlation. You can't say it was directly, but there was a correlation between Boris Johnson's comments around Muslim women and the rise in Islamophobia in this country by a massive percentage. When politicians say these words, people like me are less safe. People like you know, ethnic minority MPs and others become less safe, because what it does is it incubates the racism that led to the riots in the summer, for example, and gives it more oxygen. So I think what the Prime Minister needs to reflect on is not only the actual the politics of this, the policies that he's announced, but also, is he contributing to an environment that makes minorities in this country less safe, that puts them at risk of violent and non-violent hate crime?
Yeah, and I also want to say, I think it is reasonable for Starmer to have made arguments about fixing the immigration system. Quite clearly, the Tories created a system in the interest of big business who didn't want to pay their workers a fair living wage, so decided to rely on cheaper foreign labour, also meaning that those people coming over were more easily exploited. There was no incentive for businesses to improve workers' rights, to put up the minimum wage. And therefore, what you have now is a system that doesn't work for people in this country or immigrants, and actually it only works for big business who want cheap labour so they can line their pockets with more money. That is actually a left-wing progressive argument.
But that is not the argument he made.
Why not? You know, what that is the most convincing, and this is the argument.
But the reason why not is because it's not a substantive policy intervention. It's a reaction to the loss to reform.
Well, no, and it's also because Labour are in the pocket of big business, because they have to be, because that is how politics. You know, this is I would require massive systemic changes, and you know, I think, I mean, we need to move on. I'm sure we could talk about this all day, but I just think there are progressive arguments you can make about changing the immigration system, but you also have to acknowledge the fact that we are dependent on immigration, especially in our health and social care sector. Making it more difficult for social workers to come in when we already have a deficit, closing the dedicated visa scheme, is an insane thing to do. British people do not want to do those jobs. And yes, we need to improve. We absolutely need to improve the standard for care workers. We absolutely need to pay people more. That includes immigrant workers as well. But the idea that you can just close it, train up a new British workforce, when we already have an aging population, a massive deficit, it is political reactionary nonsense.
But can I just say, I know we don't have time, but the politics of this is really interesting as well, because what's the number one criticism Keir Starmer gets? That we don't know what he believes and that he changes what he believes and he flip-flops. Well, we've now got a politician who in his leadership election said that he wants to defend the right of migrant workers, defend migrants and close centres like Yarlswood, now saying we're an island of strangers and going to Albania to talk about return hubs. He is reinforcing the idea that he believes in nothing, that he will change his views on a whim, and that if he tells you that night follows day, you should probably stick your head out the window and double check.
Okie doke, let's move on. The government have pledged to consult on making council tax collection practices fairer. Under the current system, local authorities can demand a full year's payment if a resident misses just one monthly instalment within 6 weeks. Welcoming the move is our future Prime Minister. No, not really, but he should be. Martin Lewis, who took to social media to give his response.
It's one of those things that people don't talk about but affects millions of people. And suddenly, it's a campaign win out of nowhere. I'm very happy, slightly confused, trying to work out what work I need to do, and a little bit emotional about it. So I thought I'd just record that feeling and try and explain it to you.
Good for him. So sounds like this is a good move. And again, you know, maybe something that we should be talking more about. We should be talking about making life better for people who are...
novel idea in politics.
Yeah, I know. Why did you want to talk about this story, Ali? Because you said we should talk about it.
Yeah, so I heard this on the taxi ride from the airport, actually, yesterday, I think it was. And I didn't realise how scandalous council tax debt repayments or the way that they collect the debt on council tax can be. So if you don't know, right now, most people pay their council tax monthly. If you miss a single month's payment for any given reason, the council can then immediately ask you for 12 months, the whole year's payment, then and there. Now, if you can't afford to pay 1 month, if you miss one monthly payment, then logic dictates you're going to struggle to pay the whole year. Well, within 2 weeks of that, of asking you for the whole year's council tax, they can go to court for a judgment and then have bailiffs at your door within 6 weeks, not only asking for the entire year council tax, but also the cost of going to court and the cost of having the bailiffs at your door within 6 weeks. So if you have just one financial difficulty in 1 month, you can go from missing 1 month's council tax bill to having bailiffs at your door in 6 weeks asking for thousands of pounds, including court fees and bailiff costs. And that's coming from your own local authority.
Yeah.
And what's insane about this is actually there are standards in place for things like banks and other loans. Payday loans, for example, it takes up to a year to get to that point because they have there's this regulatory expectation of being good to consumers and allowing them time and giving you space to go to debt charities and to get your affairs in order. You don't have that with local authorities. And Martin is absolutely right to raise it. Now, the government have done what government do, right? They said, oh, we're going to look into this. So it's good news that they're going to review whether this is going to happen. But I think it is absolutely scandalous that local authorities are sending bailiffs within 6 weeks to people's doors to collect council tax.
Yeah, it is. And you know, we should say before we move on that if bailiffs ever turn up to your door, You don't have to let them in. Okay. Thousands of civil servants are going to be moved out of London under money-saving plans. Is it Groundhog Day? I think I've heard this before a number of times. The government is aiming to cut the number of roles in London by 12,000 and close 11 offices to save £94 million a year by 2032. Two new government campuses will be opened in Manchester and Aberdeen to accommodate, and roles being created in other towns and cities. Unions have welcomed the proposal but want to see more detail on how civil services would be impacted. I mean, this, every government I can think of has said this is going to happen. And it should happen.
Yeah.
But what is taking so long, Ali? Why can't... If they're going to do it, why don't they just do it?
I think it's because so much of government actually comes out of the capital city. It's actually a lot more difficult than to just move it. I think different governments have presented it with different priorities. But for Boris, it was a big thing of moving politics and power out of Westminster and into the rest of the region.
It was this big levelling up lie.
And so that was the priority. This government seems to be all about cost saving. So it's about that £94 million, which, by the way, in the grand scheme of things, in terms of the bottom number, bottom line of a government, £94 million is negligible, but I guess if everyone is tightening their belts, you understand it. Will it happen? Probably not. You just become jaded with this sort of thing because you hear it happen, have said so many times.
But the problem is, right, that a lot of government departments want to be near their minister, who is often going to be in Westminster.
Yeah,
And it actually becomes like a bit, it can be like a bit of a, you know, like, oh, what? We're moving to Manchester. We're not important. We don't have to see the minister. You know, and it's not just kind of political, but it's practical as well. Like, yeah. You know, if the minister suddenly needs to visit some particular part of the business, energy and industrial strategy, or whatever it's called now, department, and then he finds out it's in Aberdeen and he's got to get from Westminster to Aberdeen. Yeah.
How far is
on,
it?
On
far
our, it? On our bloody train on lines.
Our, yeah, I thought you were going to say on our dime.
Yeah. Yeah, and on, yeah, and on taxpayer money. Yeah. It ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
So the real elephant in the room is, when are we going to move Parliament out of Westminster?
Oh, that's never going to happen. But I this is the Londoner in me. You just make me so defensive about that's an interesting point, though. You know, 94 million we're saving. It's true. So one of the reasons it makes sense in Westminster is because MPs are in Westminster at least 3 days a week, mm-hmm. minimum, right? So it means the minister is in the city that the civil service is in. Say the Foreign Office moved to Aberdeen. Mm. Does David Lammy have to travel to Aberdeen?
Yeah. Oh, they stick the bit of the Foreign Office.
What's the cost of that?
That they think the minister doesn't have to go to, but the question is why, you know?
Yeah, I also wonder how many civil servants want to get away from their minister.
Well, it's a good question. Yeah. I mean, you could save all of this by allowing civil servants to work from home, for example, if you want to save a bit of office space.
Okay, so we're moving Parliament out of London. Where would you put it?
Wakefield. Just because that's where I grew up.
Oh, you grew up in Wakefield. Yeah. I was about to say some disparaging things about Wakefield.
How dare you?
I don't know anything about Wakefield.
You don't know anything about Wakefield? What about Wakey Wines or the centre of the Rhubarb Triangle or the pie shop?
Doesn't everyone have the pie gallery? Shops? What's the centre of the Rhubarb Triangle?
I believe it's where you get the best rhubarb.
Oh, I don't like rhubarb, so...
Okay, all right. Well, we won't put it there then. You should probably put Parliament in the centre of the country, like near...
Nottingham, Leicester.
Yeah, in Leicester, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of Muslims there, though, so...
That would wind reform up.
Rupert Lowe's just turned in, whatever.
Where would you put it?
Manchester, right next to Old Trafford.
Yeah.
Be easy trip for me.
Oh, they'd have to sort out the train line, though.
Yeah, well, and the tram service. Yeah, but Parliament will never move, but I guess I can see the logic in moving a lot of these civil service spots.
I mean, you know, the other thing is that...
What about the nation?
Being a civil servant, you don't get a huge paycheck, despite what the Times or the Telegraph may have you believe.
Yeah.
And London is very expensive to live in. So actually, if you're a civil servant, you do get a slight London weighting in your salary, but it's probably cheaper.
It's not very good for the very woke deep state to control Parliament, though.
No, they'll
That's what... That's personally, that's what worries me.
They would struggle with that. But, I mean, you know, it doesn't make sense for the government to be paying extortionate rates on Westminster buildings when they're trying to save money. I get that. But equally, what is Westminster for if not for government buildings? Like, they're trying to save money, and there have already been government departments who, once their lease is up, they've moved actually. A lot of them are moving to, like, Stratford and stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, why is it so expensive around there? I do think there is logic to these departments being...
I mean, I also think it depends. Like, so, for example, doesn't it make... Am I being really silly to say something like Government Department for Fisheries? Shouldn't that be in, like, Southampton or Portsmouth or something?
Yeah.
Is that stupid or...?
No, I don't think so.
Or, like, I guess the Department for Culture and Media can be somewhere like Liverpool or Manchester or something, like where it's...
It's just the...
So more logical rather than just rolling a dice and going, you know what, the FCDO can go to Wakefield.
Aberdeen.
In the middle
earlier.
Of the room.
Yeah, it's a good question. Speaking of the Department for Food and Rural Affairs, which you just did, I believe Steve Reed lives very near me. I keep seeing him wandering the streets.
Yeah, do you have any feedback?
I'm like, why aren't you at work? He was knocking around in South London the other day at like 6 p.m. on a Tuesday. I was like, shouldn't you be sorting out our fisheries?
I feel like as a taxpayer, you could stop.
Yeah, like, what's going
why
on?
Aren't you at work? Yeah.
Okay, all right.
I don't see any government. I saw Michael Gove once. That ruined my day.
Didn't you used to work in Westminster?
Yeah, no, I mean, where I live.
Oh, right.
Not, yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
not, I, just, not I was like, I hope you did.
I'm not walking around Westminster not seeing government.
Okay, yeah. Right, well, this is getting silly now. Let's move on. Okay, that was The Week Unwrapped. Coming up, we're going to be joined by the TUC's Nikki Pound to discuss the Employment Rights Bill, a very important piece of legislation, which is going to be debated in the House of Lords next week, maybe, I think, or at least some point. But we'll be discussing that next on Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUPAR Radio.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
The lovely Matt Phipps.
Hello. The thing that surprised me most was how much joy I took in being, like, making people feel really uncomfortable. It's so
Amen.
Good. So good.
Your mum jokes change completely.
My friend the other day, she was like, how tall is your mum? And I was like, oh, she's 6 feet under. Yeah, they did not know what to do with that. Yeah. And then you let it hang in the air.
Yeah.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way from this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUBAR Radio.
Danny Harmer, hello.
Thank you, what an introduction.
I heard in an interview, this may no longer be the case, but in 2020 you said you'd never actually read the original Tracy Beaker.
I've still never read it, and I'm gonna go down with this ship, and quite frankly, I shall never read it. I've got this far in life. And do you know what? I think it's kind of, in a weird way, I think it helped me get the part, because I had no idea of this character apart from the character that I made her.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
You might then see friends, family that require a little bit of support, financial advice. How do you go about sharing that advice, sharing that support without being condescending?
A practical tip that everyone can do that is low friction, send them financial content that you like. If you have a favorite content creator, if you see an article that you like, send them the video and just ask them, what do you think? And then that can begin a conversation around it.
Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, the Employment Rights Bill is currently being debated in the House of Lords, and the bill aims to update and enhance existing employment rights, making provision regarding pay and conditions in particular sectors, as well as making reforms in relation to trade union matters and industrial action. But some elements of the bill have come under fire, including a clause protecting workers from third-party harassment, which has been dubbed a banter ban by several right-wing politicians. So, how will this bill help protect workers, and why is it so necessary? Joining us now is Nikki Pound, who is a policy officer for women's equality at the TUC. Nikki, thank you so much for joining us today. Can you start by explaining what the Employment Rights Bill is trying to achieve?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as you said, it's about upgrading workers' rights and protections. It's a really positive and quite ambitious piece of legislation that's been introduced by the government. It's going to improve workers' rights and conditions, and it's also going to help to make work pay as well, actually, by improving living standards. There's some really common sense reforms in there that I think are just things that should have happened anyway. It's going to ban things like exploitative practices such as zero-hours contracts. Mm. There's also reforms in there to ban practices like fire and rehire, which is where people are fired and then rehired on worse terms and conditions. And we saw that with the P&O Ferries scandal, if you remember. And it also, as you said, it introduces protections for workers against third-party harassment, which is harassment from customers, clients, people who are working in often public-facing roles, call centres, that sort of thing. And we know that's a particular issue for women, but particularly young women, actually. And there's also some really good stuff in there around sick pay, so access to sick pay from day one. So again, many of your listeners might be familiar that if you get sick, often you have to go for 3 days before you get any pay. You know, not only are you putting people in a position where they either have to go to work ill and potentially risk getting even more unwell and, you know, that sort of thing, but also, you know, they're having to choose potentially between being able to pay their bills and knowing what their pay is going to be at the end of the month. And we've also got protections in the bill which are particularly important for young people, actually. So things like protection from unfair dismissal from day one. So at the moment you have to be in employment with an employer for 2 years before you get that protection from unfair dismissal. That will become a day one right. And again, you know, if you're just starting out in the workplace, you know, you're not necessarily going to have been there for that long. So these are really important provisions.
An unfair dismissal, that is where your employer can just fire you with no given reason at all. And that at the moment does not kick in until 2 years.
So you've got a long kind of qualifying period. So it's really important that people do have that protection from day one. And again, I think people think all of these measures are actually really reasonable. You know, when we have gone and spoken to voters and done polling, we found that 7 in 10 UK voters support the measures in the bill. You know, they get why banning 0 hours contracts is important. They get that, you know, third party harassment isn't about banning banter, it's about, you know, tackling issues of verbal abuse and things like that in the workplace. So it's a really popular bill, actually, and I think, you know, it's going to upgrade workers' rights, and also there's, you know, that link to the economy and boosting living standards, which, you know, we've seen such poor living standards over the last, you know, decade or so. We've seen wage stagnation. So this is a hugely important part of that and addressing that.
Right, Nikki, I'm going to try and I'm going to channel my inner Lee, 30p Lee, Lee Anderson. Lee Anderson, right?
Yeah.
Right. I'm not going to do an accent. So some of the criticisms that right-wing politicians are making, and I usually as a joke, but is that this third-party harassment ban is going to target things like pubs, sports facilities and other things, and is going to crack down on being able to kind of be free in these spaces to make jokes and make banter. Tell me why that's nonsense. I mean, I agree it's nonsense, but I have to channel Lee because Rupert has enough going on, so I have to be lead.
No, absolutely. So, you know, as you say, the bill includes this clause which will require employers to take all reasonable steps, underline the reasonable. That's actually something that's going to be set out as well, so there'll be guidance around what is reasonable. Reasonable steps are something that employers are actually already familiar with because it's a really kind of common term in employment law and tribunal.
Like reasonable adjustments and things.
Reasonable adjustments, but also, you know, these aren't going to be overly onerous things. These are about employers proactively thinking about how they can protect their workers, make sure that if something does happen, it's taken seriously. I think what we find with things like harassment, third party harassment, you know, let's take the example of if you work in a bar or a retail environment, for example, so often we hear people saying I've just got to put up with it, it's just part of the job. Actually, no, it's not, and we're not talking about jerks, we're talking about people being verbally abused, people being physically assaulted, people experiencing racialized abuse, sexist abuse directed at them.
Do you not think it's really depressing in British politics when we're talking about like real harassment, abuse, maybe even violence, the conversation even now is about, is it too onerous on the employer rather than the person, the employee being harassed and potentially targeted? Like, even now we're talking about whether it's too onerous and reasonable, that sort of stuff. I just find that stuff quite depressing, that that's the first place British politics goes. Is it not too difficult?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually, though, there are good employers out there who already, you know, are doing some of these things. Yeah. Obviously, it's an issue. We wouldn't be here talking about it and wanting this legislation if it wasn't an issue. But I think a lot of employers are already doing stuff. You know, like I was in a coffee shop the other day and you see the signs, don't you, saying we don't tolerate harassment. And actually, for me, that feels like their staff know that if somebody is abusive, they can report that and something will be done. And I think actually having clear guidance and having these steps set out will be welcomed by a lot of employers. employers, because yeah. they will just have a clearer sense of what steps they can take, what's reasonable. And actually, I think the British public get this. Mm. I mean, again, we've done loads of polling on the Employment Rights Bill. By far, the most popular measure was this.
Mm. Oh, really?
Like, yeah, it was like eight in 10. So like I said, in general, I think about 7 in 10 supported the whole bill and all these different measures. But actually, that rose to 8 in 10 mm. when you talk about third-party harassment, because that's what people get it. People understand what we're talking about here. So someone like Farage or Lee Anderson can kind of come along and be like, oh, it's a ban on banter. But actually, they're so out of touch with what working people
are. I'm surprised it's 8 out of 10.
And if your banter means making a woman, for example, feel uncomfortable in her place of work, then maybe you're not very funny.
Yeah.
And maybe there should be a law preventing you from speaking.
By the way, it's not even just, I mean, obviously the individual victim is, so I'll give you an example. I went to an England game once where I watched a bunch of fans harass a female steward, and I've not been to an England game since. Mm-hmm. I went with my family. I was like, fuck this, like, I'm not gonna, it's just not a nice environment to be in. So I think if you're a minority and you see another minority, if you're a woman, you see another woman get harassed, it has such impact on everybody.
So can I ask, so if I am, say, a woman working in a pub, for example, and somebody harasses me, maybe a customer is unpleasant to me, rude to me, discriminatory, and I report it to my boss, what does my boss then have to do if this legislation passes?
I mean, again, I think what will happen as part of the consultation on the legislation is that you'll have a consultation on what it looks like in different sectors and what is reasonable. I mean, I would think in that circumstance, I think it's reasonable to expect your employer to ask that customer to leave. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to work in retail before I worked at the TUC, and we would certainly, if we had abusive customers in the places that I worked, we would ask them to leave. We would also make sure, you know, where there's security guards and stuff, that they know who these people are in case they kind of come back. So those might be some of the steps that might be taken. And I think, again, part of this is actually about giving staff the confidence to know that their employers take it seriously and they will do what they can. And they're not going to be able to anticipate every situation, but you can definitely take steps and you can kind of create that culture that feels more welcoming and that people know they're going to be supported.
Can I
ask one question, Nikki, about if in any way this bill deals with some of the things that the Tories did in terms of making trade unions' lives more difficult in terms of organising and striking and other things. Does this bill address that?
Yes, so there's stuff in the bill around improving access rights for trade unions so that they can go into workplaces and talk to workers about what unions are, what we do, and that it'll also improve statutory recognition rights, so when you get into a workplace and you can negotiate recognition, so your workplace is then recognised by the employer, and that's then when you can implement collective bargaining, so your union goes in and bargains on behalf of the whole workforce for better pay and conditions, so it's not down to you as an individual to have that conversation. There's also some really good stuff in there, you know, from an equalities angle, and which is obviously my kind of area of expertise, around giving equality reps statutory rights. So we have health and safety reps in the workplace and things like that. It will give equality reps more rights in line with that. So it means that actually people who are specialists in understanding equality issues for young workers, for women, for BME workers, for disabled workers, can go into the workplace and kind of focus and bargain on those specific issues as well.
There was a suggestion with the day one rights stuff in the bill, which I'm not sure if it's been watered down, but there was a suggestion that this might include right to maternity and paternity leave or pay. Do you know anything about that, or whether the bill covers particular protections when it comes to paternity or maternity leave?
Yes, so there's some provisions in the bill to extend protections. So there's protections from redundancy for pregnant women and new mothers and new parents. That's going to be extended to protections from dismissal as well. So there's redundancy situations and then there's dismissal. There are also measures in the bill to give day one access to paternity leave.
Right.
That's not addressing the issues more broadly with paternity and maternity and shared parental pay, but there is also a commitment in the Make Work Pay document to do a review and publish recommendations for how to reform the whole parental leave system. Mm. We expect that to launch before the end of this first year. That was the commitment. And then they'll do a consultation on that, and hopefully we'll have some really strong recommendations on how to address the issues in that system as well.
And is there anywhere further you want this bill to go? I mean, do you think it's gone far enough to protect employees? Where do you see it landing?
I mean, obviously, you know, I'm a trade unionist. We're always going to want more.
And me too.
Yeah, absolutely.
What might be fun? What's one thing that we're not saying? Obviously, the bill sounds really great, and hopefully, it passes. But if there's one thing that you'd like to add, what would you like to say?
To be fair, I think the bill is actually, it's really ambitious. It's really giving upgrading protections for workers that are long overdue. Like, this is, you know, going to be the biggest reform to workers' rights in a generation, really. So actually, I think for us, what's crucial now is that the bill passes in full. As you've said, there's been a lot of challenges. There'll be a lot of challenges in the laws. We want to see it passed in full and delivered as quickly as possible. So I think the bill in and of itself, we're happy with that, and we just want to really support it and see it implemented. I do think the parental leave review, from the perspective of women's equality, and sort of balancing, you know, looking at the gender pay gap and parental rights, I think that will be really important.
What's the process now? Looking forward, what does it look like to get this passed into law now?
It's in the House of Lords. Hopefully it will receive royal assent this year, and then we'll start to see elements of it enacted. I think, you know, we really do want to see this just implemented as quickly as possible, because this is about raising people's living standards. Like, everybody should be able to get a job that supports their basic, not even their basic needs, gives them a good quality of life. And actually what we have seen is a real race to the bottom and a low wage kind of insecure economy that's just, you know, people can't live off it, and it's not right. And actually this bill is really going to, you know, raise that minimum floor to really support workers and to support the economy, actually. So it makes sense, and I think that's why it's so popular and people get it.
Oh yeah, absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much, Nikki. That was Nikki Pound, Policy Officer, Women's Equality at the TUC. Coming up, we've got Justice Secretary. No, we don't have her, but she has announced plans, Justice Secretary Shabana Mahmood, to open 3 more prisons and limit the duration of recall to 28 days to tackle the issue of overcrowding in prisons. And we will be speaking to a former prison governor, arguably better than the Justice Secretary, about whether this is enough to solve the problem. All that and more next.
FUPAR Radio.
What the hell with Georges Bertineau on FUBAR Radio.
I'm joined by Alex Mitten, retreat host and mentor.
I think a lot of people are lonely, surrounded by people at the minute. Like, you know, especially living in London, there's fucking people everywhere. But we sort of live these quite strange lives now where we're quite closed down emotionally, you know, even just like with our voice. We don't really speak that often sometimes. Do you know what I mean?
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
1 in 5 people in the UK are disabled. And it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When is too early to say I love you?
So I've said it the night we met.
Yeah. I did. Right, okay, right, let's just clear this up, right? When I said I love you, I remember I said it in the car.
In the cab, yeah.
In the cab, and I was like, oh my God, I love you.
Yeah, well, that was the day I made you my girlfriend, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I said, I love you, and you were like, I love you too. And I was like, I love you, 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 I love you so much, I love you so much, oh my God, I love you.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
We store so much of our trauma and our energy in our body. I am just incredibly, incredibly tired of keeping this trauma locked inside my body. And so all I needed to do is release it. You know, it's like going on a bender and drinking too much booze and you throw it up because you just need to get that out of your system because it's gonna catch up with you at some point if you don't.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUBAR Radio.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
I can announce today that the Treasury will fund our prison expansion plans in full across the spending review period. This is a total capital investment of £4.7 billion. It allows us to start building three new prisons, including breaking ground on a site near HMP Gartree later this year. This investment will also fund new cells at existing prisons, with new house blocks and rapid deployment cells opened across the country. This is a record prison expansion, and after the long delays under the last government, who allowed their backbenchers to block every project, we are building at breakneck pace.
Shabana Mahmood has announced new plans to build three new prisons as part of a record expansion plan to tackle overcrowding. The duration of recall is also set to be limited to 28 days in an attempt to deal with the ongoing crisis. The latest weekly prison population in England stands at 88,087 people. It comes as a report by former Tory Justice Secretary David Gawk is set to be published next week with a list of recommendations to tackle overcrowding, including the ability for prisoners to earn their freedom after serving a third of their sentence. But just how much of this is a plaster over a wider issue? And do we need a true reform of the criminal justice system in order to make our prisons work? Well, joining us now is Vanessa Frake-Harris, formerly Head of Security and Operations at Wormwood Scrubs. Vanessa, thank you so much for joining us.
Good evening.
Tell us what you think about the Justice Secretary's plans. Is this a step in the right direction?
Well, you know, I think this government is a little bit between the devil and the deep blue sea. If they do nothing, we risk reaching maximum capacity by November. And if that happens, then there is a chance that law and order will break down in our society. You know, police won't be able to arrest people and courts won't be able to sit because they won't be able to convict people. I think it's another sort of knee-jerk reaction, really, to our prison crisis. It's not going to solve it. These three prisons won't be coming online until 2031. It may delay it a bit until David Gawk's review comes out next week, that the government is keeping well under wraps for the moment, although they are kind of leaking the little bits here and there in order to forewarn the public that these results will be head-turning, to say the least, I think.
Mm. Hi, Vanessa. I just wonder if these are knee-jerk reactions and they won't fix the issue, in your view, what will?
Hi, Ali. I'm not sure that we have enough time here tonight to say what will fix it. It's, you know, there's no one thing that's going to fix this prison crisis. You know, the prison service is on its knees. It's been on its knees for about the last 5-6 years. And successive governments have just ignored it. They've increased sentences, but without putting in the infrastructure. And I like to compare it to, you know, if you build a new housing estate, you've got to put in infrastructure. You've got to put in doctors and shops and chemists, etc. But what this previous governments have done is increased sentences and not done anything about, you know, the number of prisons beds. And, you know, you can't sentence prisoners on what availability the beds are. And that is a worrying place to go. I think, you know, the whole justice system needs reform. David Gawke's review will be a start, but there is still much more to be done. There is vetting of staff. There is training of staff. There is dealing with the maintenance of our old Victorian prisons. You know, there is looking at community sentences, making them much more robust. There is looking at mental health issues within the prison system and outside the system. There is drug rehabs both within and without outside the prisons. You know, there is so much that needs to be done, and it's going to take much more than 4.7 billion, I'm afraid, to get it back on track, something that we can be proud of.
I want to talk to you about reoffending, because the reoffending rate, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think it's about 25%. Is that correct?
In the first year.
In
the first year, yes. Yeah. And prisoners serving under 12 months are much more likely to reoffend than prisoners serving over 12 months.
Yes, okay.
Which is why the 12 months and under sentences don't work. Mm. The stats are there. The mathematics don't lie. And, you know, the reoffending rates, you know, there are several issues with this. You know, it's inadequate resources. Mm. There's a focus on punishment rather than rehabilitation. And you know, the impact of the prisons itself. Many of our prisons are rat infested, cockroach infested, you know, have sewage running down landings, which makes prisoners disengage from the whole rehabilitation issue. So there is much to do. You know, this isn't anything that this government does isn't going to be all it is putting a plaster to get us through to the next bit. And it's going to take a long time for our prison service to come back to something that is almost, you know, what they're supposed to do, which is to protect the public, to punish and to rehabilitate. Mm. And at the moment, our prisons are warehouses where criminals just get better at being criminals.
Yeah, well, that was what I was going to ask you. You know, what is it about prison and people coming out of prison that makes them that means they aren't able to be rehabilitated, or they aren't, you know, they are more likely to reoffend again? Because quite clearly, and we know that there are some companies that do, for example, provide jobs to people who have been in prison and do it very proudly. For example, Timpson's, who's now, obviously James Timpson is now the prisons minister, and other companies as well, like Redemption Roasters, for example. But there is still a stigma attached in our society to people having been a convicted criminal. I mean, do you think there is a cultural shift here where we need to maybe be a nation that is less obsessed with punishment and punishment forever, and more committed to reforming people and giving them a second chance at life?
Without a doubt, Zoe. You know, look, the latest stats for the cost of a per prisoner place per year is £57,000. We lock up at the moment, as you said, 88,000 and a few. You know, I was actually really pleased that, you know, Keir Starmer had the nous about him to employ Lord Timpson as one of the justice ministers. And I had great hopes for him being, because he has worked in prisons. He has taken convicted prisoners into Timpson's and Cobblers before it was Timpson's, you know, for many, many years. And I had high hopes for that. Unfortunately, I haven't heard much from James Timpson. I saw him on the TV the other night, and he spoke very well. But I think he needs to speak out much more. We need to focus on rehabilitation. Rehabilitation is a bonus win for us all. You know, less crime in our communities and less money for people in prison. So less taxes on prisons and going to things like the NHS and to education, where they should be going. And I think it's going to take the general public a while to get their heads around that.
And can I just ask you quickly, and then I'll let Ali come in, but, you know, people will say on the right particularly that harsher sentences will stop people from committing crime. Is that true? Because, you know, you just said there have been more severe sentences put in by the Tory government, and now we have an overflowing prison population. That is one of the factors. Is there evidence that actually making sentences harsher and more restrictive means people are less likely to commit crime?
No, not at all. Not at all. You know, taking somebody's liberty away at the moment doesn't deter them from going out and committing further crimes, because they don't get the help, the why they committed the crime in the first place, and dealing with those issues, whether that be childhood issues or drug, alcohol, whatever. And that is part of the problem. Mm. You know, I don't believe that, you know, threatening people with sentences is a deterrent. You know, hardened criminals almost wear prison as a badge.
Mm.
And we need to look at that. We need to actually sort of understand that, you know, lock them up and throw away the key doesn't work.
Mm.
Because at some stage you've got to let those people out back into the community.
Vanessa, I wonder if I can ask you a little bit about some of the violence in prisons that we're now seeing. I don't know if it's, maybe I'm just paying attention to it more, but I've seen a fair few headlines in the last 6 months of prison officers being attacked, either boiling water thrown on them, being stabbed, other things. Is that on the rise? And as well as that, what can we do to better protect prison staff against violence?
Okay, well, look, if I said to you, Ali, that up to September 24th last year, the number of assaults over a 12-month rolling period was 10,500 on prison staff, and 11% of those were serious assaults.
10,500.
The fact is, yes, the fact is that because of the recent assaults by high-profile prisoners who have committed mass murder, this has been highlighted now. And quite rightly, you know, the Prison Officers Association, who look after their members, you know, are now giving literally a blow-by-blow account of prison officers that have been assaulted, whether that be at Huell or wherever, in the last couple of days. You know, they have to look after their members. Our prison officers are our greatest asset. And we should be looking after them. And without a doubt, you know, the likes of Abidi and Ruda Cabana, they are not what I would class as normal prisoners. Mm. They are very dangerous, very calculating, manipulative prisoners who will think nothing of trying to attempt to murder prison staff, whatever grade or uniform or not they wear. They have an ideology that ensures that's not going to be changed. They don't engage with staff. They don't engage with programs. These people are never going to be rehabilitated. Mm. And in my mind, the prison service, the Ministry of Justice, appeased them. You know, why Abidi was allowed unfettered access to a kitchen with oil and implements that could be fashioned into sharp implements. We were very lucky that the three staff that were stabbed at Franklin and thrown boiling water over weren't murdered.
Mm.
And it's going to take, you know, the Ministry of Justice is so slow saying, you know, oh, we're having a snap investigation into whether prison officers should be issued. Why?
Mm.
Why are we talking about it? You've got the figures. From last year, you had the figures. You know, do something about it. What is the problem with giving every single prison officer a stab vest? You go to your local Tesco's, on the door is a security man with a stab vest on.
Mm.
Doesn't intimidate me. Doesn't prevent me from going in and getting my groceries. So why should our prison officers, you know, everybody who does whatever job they do has the right to go to work and be safe and go home to their families at night, without a doubt.
Vanessa, thank you. I just want to ask you one really brief question. If you could 30 seconds, I know it's a massive ask because it's a huge topic, but if there was one thing you want to see in David Gawk's review coming out next week, what would it be?
It would be to stop the short sentences, to the 3-month sentences or the 6-week sentences or that 6-month sentences, because actually as a prison, there's nothing you can do with somebody who's serving that short a sentence. And actually that person is better served with robust community service, not in a prison. You know, somebody who goes into a jail for a couple of weeks, all that will end up is they will lose their home, they will lose their support services, they're probably if they're working, they'll lose their job. And when they go out a couple of weeks later, they've got nothing. So what have they got? They return to crime.
Vanessa, thank you so much. That was Vanessa Frake Harris, formerly head of security and operations at Wormwood Scrubs.
That's it from Politics Uncensored today. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBAR Radio or via the FUBAR Radio app.
Make sure you download it from your app store now.
Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.